Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle, and our goal here at We Are Libertarians is to help you sound smarter while talking politics with your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news to make you think. I'm Chris Spangle, and this is a special series on We Are Libertarians called The Swamp Explained. And my co-host on this venture is Rob Quartel, a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C. Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate. And given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoints, Rob always gives us a great insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital. We do have a standalone feed if you want to go back and listen to some of the past episodes, how we managed to weirdly meet one day, and his past work with people like George H.W. Bush. It's very interesting, and always great to talk to you, Rob. It's been a little too long. We always shoot for every 2 weeks. But I'm just glad that we're still doing it.
2 months.
Yes. And every time what should we talk about? There's no news. And there's always, as a joke, because there's a million different things going on.
Yep. Well, and today I'm coming to you from the swamp itself.
Are you in D.C.?
I am. Yeah, I'm in my little pied-à-terre in the Navy Yard.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So now you do what when you do all kinds of different business when you're in DC? Cause normally you're now kind of, I don't want to say you're retired because you're a very busy person. What would you say your life is kind of like? You bounce between these different places and you do work in between.
Yeah.
Like, what are you in DC for, like, now?
Today.
Right.
Well, that's a good question. So, you know, one of the things that I've been involved with trying to get started is the idea of maritime innovation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work with a lot of startups and serve on various technology boards and all that. And one of the things I've been interested in for some time is how you bring innovation and new technologies to the maritime industry. And so it turns out it's a new area for venture capitalists. I think they've run out of other areas, so it's what you call a vertical.
Time to ruin another industry is what you're saying.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, well, it's very interesting, and there's some really interesting big players starting to look at this. One of the most interesting is a group called Mass Challenge, and they're out of Boston. They have, I think, 7 or 8 or 9 different city verticals. One of the companies that I've been advising, for example, is a company that has a way to lay fiber, cable fiber and optical fiber directly on a hard surface. So that's really important potentially if you want to get broadband out to parts of the country that aren't served. And, you know, probably about 70% of the physical area of the United States, and certainly in Virginia, where I spend most of my time, is not served by either cell phone or high-speed broadband. And that's a big deal. You know, it's a big deal for two of the key potential constituencies, one of which is the elderly, who could benefit from all of this new medical technology. So, for example, earlier this year, I met a guy who was wearing a ring that measures his blood pressure, his temperature, his heartbeat.
Oh, wow.
And of course, as it goes along, these things will be able to do more and more things. And it relies on having high-speed broadband. And so think about that. You're an elderly patient. You could be monitored from 1,000 miles away or down the street. And so there's both in real-time monitoring, and then there's predictive monitoring. And all the data of your history and everything, and then you say, well, if it hits this, it's going to do that. And if you don't have broadband, you can't get it. And one of the least served groups, underserved groups, is the elderly. And then the flip side of that is the young people and students. And so in the county in which I live, about 35% of the students are not served. The Commonwealth of Virginia is putting about $20 million into that annually to try to help people do deals with the cable companies to extend broadband. But honestly, the cable companies are reticent. And And this is a 10-year plan. So think about it. Kids are in school for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And if it takes 10 years, you're going to miss almost a whole generation of kids in this particular county, a third of the kids. So, and all of the data shows that they're substantially disadvantaged in other opportunities, and they're not as facile with internet as their peers. Now, they get it at school, but who wants to go to school and live there? You know, in the middle of the night, they can't.
They ban all the good websites. So
yeah, and they ban all the good websites, right? Yeah, they ban all the porn.
Right. Can't even watch cartoons. Anyway.
Right. So, but the point is, so anyway, so you know, so this company is called Traxel. Actually, just won one of these mass challenge opportunities out in Austin, which is a very different vertical than, let's say, the one in Boston. And they got $150,000, and that's really important, you know, if you're in an early stage. And they also happen to get $1.4 million for the Army, which is even better, but
right.
It's a real project. But so that's one of the things I've been interested in. And so, for example, you asked why I was here. So I was specifically here for a meeting with the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard, and and I'd never met him.
It sounds like something out of Anna Karenina. I was there meeting the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard.
Well, you know, every time I do this, when I became Maritime Commissioner, I knew virtually nothing about it. I knew a lot about regulation, but not much about, and, you know, somewhat typical political appointee. I knew a lot about something, but not necessarily about that specific agency. And partly that's why I was put in it. But, I was contacted by a guy I didn't know who was 15 years younger than I was, who had gone to the Yale Management School 10 or 15 years behind me, as I had. And he was a Coast Guard lieutenant commander who was going to retire in 6 months. And he and I, we talked, and then I, out of the blue, called the commandant of the Coast Guard, a guy named Bill Yost, and I said, could he come work for me as my special assistant in his last 6 months? And the commandant did. This guy, what I've always found is the U.S. Coast Guard, and you know, we talk about the swamp and all these kinds of things in the deep state. These are very competent people, and I'm reminded of that every time I meet them. And they don't have politics doesn't govern them. Well, politics can govern what they do, but they personally aren't governed by politics. And he assigned them to me, and he really kind of taught me all of the non-book stuff about the maritime industry. And you know, again, this is sort of an example of the way politics in the swamp works. So I was nominated. I sat at the Department of Transportation. I was given a consultant salary, which was not a whole lot, but for 6 months, and while I waited to be confirmed. And in that time frame.
And this is what year?
This would have been 1990, okay. 89.
Gotcha.
In the fall, I was nominated in the late fall of 89. And then I had run the transition operation for the administration, the new Bush administration, for that agency. And but my point is, while you're in these waiting, you get approached by all of the lobbyists for all of the interests that you govern. And I had, you know, talked to and received lobbyists from the maritime labor unions and the big shipping companies and ship owners and operators and all that. And then out of the blue one day, I got a call from a guy representing, I think it was Nike, and one of the two big shoe companies. And he said, you know, it's not just about ships and sailors. It's also about the customers. And he brought in a guy from DuPont, which sounds like, you know, one of these big super duper chemical companies, which of course it is and was. But they were the people who goods moved on the ships. And their story was 180 degrees different than the story of the ship owners and operators and the shipyards and the maritime labor unions. And it just reminded me, and that became when I became commissioner, that shipping and all transportation really exists to benefit the customer, mm-hmm. the American industrial customer or whatever. And, you know, something like 90 98% of all of the goods consumed from overseas, which is about bigger than a quarter of our economy, comes on ships. So it was a good thing. And right. So they had done that. And then, of course, I finally get my hearing, which I told you about that in one of the episodes, and got confirmed. And actually, just as a reminder, I went to the hearing. Senator Breaux was from Louisiana, was in charge. And he asked this one question over 15 different ways. And I couldn't figure out what he wanted. And finally, I said, Senator Breaux, we're gonna make sure it's fair, free trade. And that was that. And he said, that's what I want to hear, Mr. Quartel. We'll have you confirmed tomorrow. And I was. And Elaine Chao, who is now Secretary of Transportation, who had served there as chairman a while back, she swore me in at the White House and all that. It was a great time. But so Bill Zack, who was the Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander, came on board, and he, you know, it was very similar to the story from the consumer side. It was about how these things actually operated. And I told the guy today that story, and as it turns out, small world, he had been one of his instructors at the Coast Guard Academy.
And they always know each other. That's what.
Oh, they do. Well, it's a small service. Yeah. And
I'm just talking about the swamp. You mention a name, you're like, oh yeah, that was my supervisor back in 1987.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, but the Coast Guard is small, and it's very highly professional, and you know, they are, and I don't want to name any names. You know, this guy's conversations are confidential, of course, but. And he had a terrific and interesting role, and we had lunch at the mess, really nice. But I'm always reminded these are the people who toil behind the scenes, and they probably have more contact with the American public than any other agency of the United States government, with the possible exception of the Department of Agriculture and the Field Extension Services and stuff. But, you know, they're, I don't know how many millions of boaters there are, but the Coast Guard's all out there doing that. But, you know, they're also, they're involved in intelligence collection and up in the Arctic Circle and all around and on the oceans. And wherever we have wars, they are there on the front line in the harbor stuff. And so they're just a very, very competent group of people. And they do this with a lot of diligence. So, that was the main reason I was here. And then, of course, once I'm here, I have make sure I have a bunch of meetings. And as it turns out, my wife, one of her boards is up here. And then she is going to be flying to Nashville tomorrow for a conference with them. And I'm going to play the tag-along spouse and follow behind her by about a day. So I missed the really boring stuff. And
but you still get the hot chicken. So
yeah, right. I don't know if we're going to have hot chicken. We are going to go to the Grand Ole Opry. So I might have. I don't have a particular restaurant recommendation necessarily today. But when I see you next time, I'll have a Grand Ole Opry story and some recommendations from Nashville.
Well,
because
very good.
I've already made some reservations. So that's why, you know. And of course, I typically will meet with. My new CEO and one of my friends has characterized me as having fired myself and brought in new CEO. So I'm not really retired. I spent some time with that and I'm having a dinner with tonight with the chairman of another company on the board of which I sit. And tomorrow I have a lunch with a couple people and a bunch of phone calls, and some of which are related to this new idea of the maritime, and some related to agricultural technology. So it's pretty busy.
Yeah,
and I'm going to get a haircut.
Yeah, I know you're getting a little bit. I almost thought you were about to
shaggy,
throw your medals.
I hate to say it, but I'm afraid to get a haircut down where I live. You know, I put a bowl in my head. You know.
I know. You look like you're about to throw your medals over the Congress
right.
steps.
Yeah, right. So here we are in the swamp, and they're having hearings not even a mile away from me.
So it is funny to hear you kind of talk about some of these guys, because I have been struck. Is the great thing about hearings and kind of the impeachment process and the Russian stuff and all that you get to see people like William Taylor, the ambassador to Ukraine, or the former Ukrainian ambassador, when she testified, or some of these career politicians, George Kent with the bow tie and the great bottle of water, the blue bottle of water that I myself constantly have at my hand, and
right.
Republicans are making fun of him for. But you do get a sense when you see some of these people that, and I always kind of tell people this, just based on my own experience here in local politics, I think libertarians especially, but just people in general, especially those who kind of have a diet of like Fox News or MSNBC or TV information.
You mean the impeachment channels?
Yeah, right. The entertainment channels, yeah. Essentially. When people work in government, they aren't necessarily the caricature that they're often made out to be. A lot of times, like somebody said today, oh, well, Mueller was a Republican, and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, was a Republican. I go, yeah, these guys may have been registered Republicans, but they're not Republicans. Most people who work in the bureaucracy of a government or work in a governmental system at local, state, or federal levels, they're usually nonpartisan. They're not like your typical Republican that you'd see on Facebook or out walking and canvassing neighborhoods. They're different.
Yeah. Well, you and I started to talk about it. It's, I was just in Santa Fe for 4 or 5 days a couple weeks ago, and I was in Houston for board meetings for 4 days after that. And just to lay down a baseline here is I actually don't think most of the people I was around actually gave much of two cents worth about any of this. They were, you know, aware of it. These are all very smart people. I'm sure they had an opinion. I'm sure their opinion was largely based on how they voted in the last presidential election. Because, you know, if you look at the polling data, it's sorting itself that way.
Yeah.
It's the same percentage of people, plus or minus one, who voted for Hillary Clinton, favor his impeachment now and removal, and the same percentage of people who voted for Trump, plus or minus one or two, oppose it. And so I think that's certainly the way it is in the middle of the country, and where you are, I suspect it's very similar. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It's a really good, if you watch it, it's a good representation of people who do work in the government. So for example, the former ambassador.
Is it Yanukovych?
Yanukovych. Yeah. Okay. I will say I'm not as sympathetic, where I stand on Trump, and there's no question.
Well, for our new listeners, go ahead and articulate that just a little bit.
Well, I didn't vote for him, and I didn't vote for Hillary. I voted for McMullen. I'm happy to say that, and I can't imagine voting. You know, I'm a lifelong Republican. I've never voted for Democrat, but there are just a lot of Republicans I don't vote for, and on a variety of things. And so I think of myself as a traditional, true Burkean conservative. So I think government institutions are really important. I think that they do have to change. It needs to be evolutionary, unless you have something big that needs being revolutionary. And I think, I certainly personally prefer to stay out of other people's business. And lots of different variations of that. So I'm not fond of the guys that are in there right now. But so my point about that, though, is Yanukovych was certainly a career diplomat. She has quite a long history. I don't know whether she is good, bad, or indifferent, to be perfectly honest. I do think that what you see is the State Department the State Department professionals rallying around her by and large. And I think they would have done that around virtually anyone. I thought it was interesting. We went for 2 days virtually of hearings, and it was all about how terrible it was. The president fired her for this reason or that reason, and he was doing this. And of course, they're talking about maneuvering her out of the way so he could do something else that I think that's the narrative they're talking about. But the reality is, she pointed out, the ambassador serves at the pleasure of the president. He can fire for a reason or for no reason whatsoever. And it doesn't matter whether it's a good reason or a bad reason or a legitimate reason or not. So at the core of that, and again, remember,
let's put it this way. John Adams was recalled by Washington. I think it was Washington for just being, or the Continental Congress, excuse me.
Right.
Just for being a little difficult. And Franklin didn't really like him all that much.
Right.
You know, he was sent to Amsterdam.
Well, and the notion that, that ambassadors are fully informed all the time is also not true. There's supposed to be, you know, foreign governments look at our ambassadors as being the representative of the president of the United States as much as the country. So that's why it's the pleasure of the president. So
isn't it just a patronage system at this point, really?
I mean, no, it's not. No. It is patronage at one level. And I want to qualify that. It's not necessarily bad or good either. You know, what you get, I think it's probably roughly 80% of all of the ambassador jobs today. It used to be 100%. Today, it's about 80% are from the professional ranks, people who work their way from the bottom to the top. So they're very skilled, and they, you know, some of the best people I know have been professional from the State Department. You know, my company has, I have a company that operates in Jordan and Iraq, and met in that time an ambassador there who was just, he's spectacular, and he was in Jordan, and then he was assigned to Iraq. He did a great job there, not only representing the country, but as a private company, he was immensely helpful and articulate to the government, and he was that way for everyone. And then he finally retired, and he went into the private sector, and he's done extremely well. He's the kind of person who, you know, you're so glad he had a full career in the government, and then he went on to make some money somewhere. But so these guys, so that's the kind of guy who sits in about 80% of the jobs, and he's, you know, you want people who can speak the language and understand the culture and have a full understanding of the socio-military, demographic, everything else about these countries. And yes, you're right. There's some percentage which are pure patronage. They are typically people who've given a lot of money or their friends or whatever. Well, they're in the big posts. They're in Paris and they're in London and they're in Italy probably, and the Bahamas, which, by the way, is really important because that's a big drug trafficking area. Hmm. And of course, they rely on this whole architecture of what you would call the deep state if you're a negativist, or the swamp, or whatever, or you could call them the professional cadres. And typically in places like London and Paris, they appoint very, very wealthy people because these are very, very expensive posts, and frequently they're expected to reach into their own pockets and redecorate and fix up these decrepit old embassies and then throw big parties and it comes out of their pocket.
Okay. So like a guy like Sondland, who is ambassador.
He was a patronage.
Right.
Guy.
He was a guy who had given millions to Trump and then he was made ambassador to the EU. So a guy like that is picked because he's rich to go fix up the house. So the government doesn't have to pay for it.
Potentially.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yes. But on the other hand, think about this. NATO is really important. It's typically it would be somebody who probably knew the president better, I don't get the sense that Sondland knew Trump all that well before all this.
Yeah,
but you know, I have certainly known ambassadors in NATO who knew the president they served really well, but on the other hand, for something like NATO, you want somebody there who is intelligent, has been successful in other walks of life, is capable of dealing with other people as senior leaders and all that, and whom the president has, you know, full faith in what they do. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that he was a political appointee. Now you can gauge each one separately by how well they do. So to me, a lot of the conversation going on around these guys and women is it's fluff. And it's really kind of irrelevant. It's irrelevant that he was a political appointee, but they sort of make a big deal out of that. It's irrelevant that Yanukovych was fired because the president can fire anybody anytime for any reason. What's going on is you're seeing them build a narrative. And the president was maneuvering to remove her so he could get somebody else in who would do his bidding and blah, blah, blah. And that may well be the case.
Yeah, to give people some cliff notes, she was essentially – Rudy Giuliani was working in the country at the time because Trump has a lot of theories that Ukraine was more important in helping Hillary and trying to hurt right. him.
Well, it was specifically around the supposed computer.
Yeah,
remember
the server, CrowdStrike server, and so he thinks that there's a gold mine of information in the Ukraine, essentially, that if he can get the right investigations in the Ukraine, it will vindicate him and it will basically exonerate him too. And so he had Rudy Giuliani working in Ukraine, and Rudy, through his security work, basically found some of what I would say the State Department, the permanents, we'll call them instead of the deep state, they were on the opposite side of the people that Giuliani were talking to, because they were giving Giuliani a lot of bad information, who was funneling it back to Trump, giving him a lot of bad information. And then on the other side, you had Yanukovych and the permanent class of ambassadors and State Department folks there going, no, that's not the way this works. We're trying to remove corruption. And so he fired her because he wanted her to stop being a roadblock to what he wanted. He brings in William Taylor, who isn't the official ambassador currently because nobody has apparently can get confirmed in the Trump administration. They can't staff properly. And so, you know, then he starts. So he has Sondland. Trump has Sondland kind of working with Rudy in some aspects, along with Rick Perry, the energy secretary, who's trying to sell natural gas. You have several other players. You have and Taylor just kind of goes, something's not right here. Things are not adding up. I don't understand what Giuliani's doing. There's different channels of communication. Right. And so, you know, now you have all these people coming out and testifying as to their sense that things were wrong. But the problem in my mind, and I'll ask you kind of what your feeling is, I certainly understand the issue and possibly impeachable offense of a president circumnavigating his own employees, essentially, for political purposes to try and dig up dirt on future political opponents and withholding congressionally mandated funds for those purposes. I have a real problem with that. But I also have to look at this and go, all right, with Nixon, you had Butterfield in the tapes and him ordering on, you know, with several people in the room to destroy tapes. You had the blue dress with Clinton that was the concrete evidence. Right. The problem with a lot of these people.
Well, and also the lie to the
you had prosecutor. Him on tape lying, you know? And so with this situation, if you're going to push impeachment, there seems to be nothing here that puts you in the Oval Office with the president saying, I want you to do this. Sondland may be the only person, and he may be looking at Michael Cohen and some of these other people and going, I'm not going to be his patsy. I'm not going to jail. I'm going to tell the truth. But still, even then.
I think it's worth reeling back some of this, too, because, again, all that you've outlined is actually a really good example of how Washington and the swamp, or whatever you want to call it, actually works. The thing that I am always struck by is how everyone is just so shocked. Shocked. I am just shocked.
What do you mean there's gambling going on?
President. Yes, that a president would compartmentalize what he does. I'm shocked that a president would have a secret private ambassador. I am just shocked that the president might do politics. You know, I have little sympathy for Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, when he said, get over it. You know, people do it. Politics is in foreign policy. And I have no idea whether he meant get over, you know, what Trump did or just politics in general. But the reality is that presidents do sidestep their own bureaucracy. They do things in secret, which, you know, some may or may not be what you would want to think presidents do, but they do, hopefully.
Especially in areas of foreign policy where you don't want other countries don't want
to. Totally.
Like, yeah.
Totally. And of course, what we forget, and this is, you know, over the years, the campaign finance laws have become very delicate around this stuff. What we forget is the president is both the political figure and the chief executive, and he lives in and works in his house. So it's almost impossible for a president to separate politics from his day-to-day existence. And every decision has some political angle. And politics is not a dirty word. We've come to believe it is, but it's not. It's about a political process of people trying to work through different points of view. And everybody comes to everything with some point of view. Once they have, they come in frequently with a point of view, and then they may learn something that changes it. But people do come in with a philosophical or ideological point of view. And so I find it amusing and that, you know, now we have the political class and the media and all those, as I say, being just shocked that a president would have somebody like Giuliani go over. Now, was Giuliani acting on his own? Who knows? I'm sure it'll come out. And a lot of times people interpret what they want to interpret. If you may remember, who will rid me of this damn priest? Yeah. History and that may be some of what's going on. And of course, that's how you get in trouble too. And you know, Trump is unusually not in control of his own government. And part of that is because he has an unusual number of open slots and vacancies across in the political class, which you need to be able to control government.
Well, he's generally at war with his own government.
Yeah, it's because he doesn't have his own people. He hadn't nominated people to do it. So,
right.
And I'm sure we can get the numbers for the next show because that's an interesting topic in and of itself.
Well, you know, I think that's an important point for libertarians to understand. Gary Johnson wins the presidency, and the next day you're filled. Your government is staffed with what? All of the Cato Institute? Okay,
3,000 or 4,000 people.
Yeah, right. What do you do with the other 3,800 people? So
yeah, So it's, but anyway. So so for me, I look at all this and I think, well, who knows? It may be impeachable, but the problem is there's not a lot of credibility on either side. I think the Democratic problem is that they have, as has been pointed out, there have been people calling for Trump's impeachment since the election. I do think there are there's a set of people who has never accepted the outcome of the election. I don't like the outcome. I wouldn't have liked either way, right. But you know, it was the election and it was legitimate and he got elected. Their excuses, I think people have not figured out that Hillary Clinton lost because she lost the election. And yes, the Russians interfered and blah, blah, blah. And you have the social media and you have all of the crazies in there. And I have a friend who was one of those crazies and sending out this information. So, and on the other side, you have people who didn't expect to win and they've sort of never been credit for winning. So it's been a battle from day one. So that's really what you're seeing, I think, in a lot of ways. So I think the problem with this particular instance is that it's, my personal opinion is that, and I think the opinion of a lot of people, if you really push them, is it's bad. I do think that Trump went into the presidency with a very negative view of the Ukraine. The Ukrainian government has been corrupt for quite a while. The Obama administration viewed it as corrupt. I think anybody standing back would agree that the fact that Hunter Biden accepted a board seat of a company that was under investigation that paid him $84,000 a month.
Jeez.
You know, that is a Fortune 500 in the United States will pay you $300,000 to $400,000
a year
for board seat, $500,000 for board seat. Yes. This was not a Fortune 500 company. It was a Ukrainian gas company. And so they were paying him $600,000 plus a year. When his father was over there, he went with him in the airplane to the Ukraine. He hitched a ride. I'm sure Biden paid for his son's flight. That, you know, I'm sure he covered all those bases. And I don't mean that in a negative way. So anyone objectively would question the intelligence of his doing it. Yeah. You know, was that legal or illegal? I doubt it was any of those things. But was it intelligent? No, it was pretty damn stupid on Hunter Biden's part. And I honestly, I'm sorry, I don't really believe that somebody in Biden's staff didn't know what was going on. If they didn't tell Biden and he wasn't aware, that's massive incompetence. So
I was just watching the show about the royal family and Prince Prince Edward.
Prince Andrew. Edward, right.
Well, Prince Edward was in the movie industry and was trying to get a career going in creating films, and once he realized everybody was only asking him to join their project because he was His Royal Highness,
right,
and not because of his particular gifts, he got frustrated and just quit the industry. You know, you have a person who has that kind of stature because you think it might get you some influence. Whether Burisma knew or did not know,
of course they knew.
You know, Hunter Biden, their intention, I believe, was to put him on the board because they think they could funnel information back to the vice president, because they think that our government works like their government, which is working on backroom.
That's really
deals.
True.
Right.
Yes.
And so their intentions were totally, whether you can't prove that Hunter Biden didn't pick up the phone or did pick up the phone and talk to his dad and all that kind of stuff. But there was definitely an intent on Burisma's part to have Hunter Biden in this position because he was Hunter Biden.
Well, and the point one of the points you're making is that other governments think we are like them.
Right.
And I have to say that the fact of the Trump administration, Trump's daughter and son-in-law and all these other people being engaged in the government, I understand why someone who is young and intelligent and from New York and all that would want to be. And I don't question their desire to serve the country. But it's questionable as to whether they should do it for all sorts of different kinds of reasons, the way it looks. But so I don't believe that Hunter Biden should have been his excuse necessarily, but the media is sort of flipping past this. And of course the right wing is making it all about Hunter Biden, and the left wing is making it all about Trump and the phone call and Hunter Biden. And you know what all of this lacks is a Sam Irvin Baker, Senator Baker from Tennessee. And the two of them, if you go back to Watergate, they were kind of a great duo. Sam Irvin, you know, they had the Senate hearings first, remember, and then they sent their investigation, Watergate investigation, over to the House, if I recall, which was drafting articles, and it was so clear that Nixon resigned. So Nixon was never impeached, the only person who's been impeached besides Andrew Johnson was Bill Clinton, In normal circumstances, there are plenty of things that the Senate and the House could have done, which might have been more appropriate and for which they would have, in my opinion, received more support. And they could have censured him. And, you know, several presidents have been censured for one thing or another. I suspect that a lot of Republicans who are so ticked off about and horrified by this and ticked off by the Syrian action and other things would have voted for censure. So I suspect they would have had a pretty good vote on that.
Oh, yeah. You remember Syria? I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right.
Remember all that? Helsinki? Yeah. I forgot all about Helsinki.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's sort of my point is they shot themselves in the foot because the Democrats since day one have been trying to impeach this guy. And it's like, if you just kept your powder dry, independents like yourself and I would be a little more like, all right, yeah, but you've been trying to do this all along.
Yes. So it's probably impeachable. He probably did it. They'll probably be able to build that story. But I think there's a question as to whether they're credible impeachers.
Right.
You know, because they lost their credibility when they started calling for impeachment back at the beginning. And there is a thread of legitimacy to the issue of of corruption in the Ukraine. There's some thread of legitimacy in the Hunter Biden thing. And of course, but I do think, you know, if we reel this back to this issue we should look at history, and this is, you know, these people, Ship, these guys do not have any of the physical, you know, they don't have the physical presence.
Right.
And they certainly don't have the detachment that Howard Baker and Sam Ervin exhibited, and that committee exhibited way back during Watergate. And what? And they were kind of peeling back facts, layers of facts.
Yeah, you've got Barry Goldwater going over to the White House the night, the day before the president resigned, going, "Hey, they got you. You're screwed. You don't have the vote."
Yeah.
Like, you guys, you know, Adam Schiff is playing this role of, I don't know who the leaker is. I'm just waiting to see the outcome.
Well,
of this.
And of course, the leaker, you know, got to him first.
Right.
Of course, what I'm surprised about, and I completely support the fact that the leaker, you know, the law protects him. They shouldn't be going after him. But the other side of that, if I were the Trump people, what I'd be saying is, look, under the Constitution, you have a right to be confronted by your accuser. And so all these other people are essentially building evidence. So they're the witnesses,
right,
but they are not the accuser. And although I guess Schiff would say that he's the accuser, but you know, so today, for example,
my point was, this past weekend, he's in California after a week of going, I'm just above all this. He's at a Democratic rally going, we're going to get the guy, you know, like fairly insane that I don't think the public trusts Schiff or Pelosi or any of these, much to your point about Ervin and Baker.
But yeah. So the name of this show is Explaining the Swamp, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about sort of how it works, and when you look at the parade of witnesses, you really do see quite an array of people. So you saw the ambassador first, and she did a credible job, but of course Schiff, you know, when he says, well, you know, the president's tweeting against you right here, well, how do you feel? Well, of course, she was going to say, well, I feel intimidated. And so it's a set play, you know. And but you've seen sort of minor people. You know, I thought it was interesting that several of Pence's staff who were involved. And of course, Trump's MO is to attack everybody. And it'd be interesting to know how Pence is dealing with this. I'm sure he knows the young woman, and I'm sure that she's perfectly competent. And then you have Volker, you know, former ambassador, saying that he should have recognized it as an attempt for politics, but he didn't, and now he does. And you know, people are amending their testimony. But you do have an array of people who are competent and represent kind of the full raft of political appointees and National Security Council professionals. And of course, I have known many, many people at the NSC, and they're typically smart, intelligent, well-educated, apolitical. Most of them served through several different political, you know, presidencies. And it's the same thing in State Department. Now, if you're on the other side of this and you say, well, the deep state is out there and they're undermining me, which is what Trump is now saying, you know, you sort of have an argument too, because the deep state kind of runs on a set of rules and things that we have been decided for a long time. And it takes something extraordinary, typically a politician, to disrupt it. So let me give you two examples of foreign policy things that have been supported by the establishment, the deep state, et cetera, that have totally discombobulated a lot of people in the State Department and the foreign policy establishment. One, and they're both around Israel, one of which was Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Now, that has been official U.S. policy and UN policy for 30 some 40 years, and right. every year the government certifies or something. I can't remember what the exact process is there, that no, we're not going to do it this year. We're not going to do it this year. We don't want to destroy the karma in the Middle East, and the talks are going on and it's stable and wide, you know. And so all of a sudden Trump does it and makes Bibi Netanyahu really happy and hoping to influence the election. And of course, Netanyahu did not win. Didn't lose, but he didn't win. Mm-hmm. And So that utterly discombobulated the State Department and the foreign policy establishment. It made Chuck Schumer happy because he has a large constituency that is excited about that. We have another one of those actions this week where for decades, it has been official U.S. policy and United Nations policy that the Jewish settlements and incursions into the Palestinian territory that the Israelis conquered however many decades ago, that those are illegal and against international law. So we have the scene 2 days ago or yesterday of Mike Pompeo, Secretary of the State, declaring all of a sudden that they are not illegal and it is not inconsistent with international law, even though everybody else thinks it's inconsistent. And, of course, you have a set of people, all the State Department people and everybody else waving their hands and going crazy, and the whole foreign policy establishment around the world saying it's going to destroy the, you know, peace in the Middle East. Well, we don't have peace in the Middle East. We just right. have sort of detente in the Middle East. And, you know, part of me thinks that this is the sad part of the Trump administration. They came in to be disruptors. And, you know, in the technology world, what you want to be is disrupt an industry. You know, think about Amazon, which first disrupted books and then disrupted deliveries and now is disrupting, you know, with the cloud and all these things and other companies that have disrupted the way people do business. And over time, we generally think that's a good thing. Certainly anybody in my line of work. And I think that's probably a good thing in foreign policy and, you know, various kinds of government things. And but because of the way they go about it, they sort of lose the importance of it and they lose the benefit they would get from doing it. It feels as if it's not part of a well thought through policy. And, you know, everybody in the deep state and all this, they like to think they have sort of a policy path that they've thought through what they're doing, and then they decide, and then they do it. And the problem is they do it over and over and over and over and over again. And it becomes a status quo. So this is the kind of the tragedy of these people in this administration. They had some opportunity to both disrupt, take a lot of things off the table that, and I think they've lost all of the value.
They're going to be completely obsessed. I think to put a kind of a bow on what you're saying, and it's something that I've thought a lot about, it is confusing for your average person. All of this is very confusing because you have reasonable arguments from both sides. You have on the establishment side and the left, you have the argument that, listen, this president is completely out of control. He's erratic. He's awful. And these are the safeguards in place to keep him hemmed in. And look, mm-hmm. the system is working. And then on the right, you do have, I am not unsympathetic to the argument that, look, the deep state is after me. Look at Page and Strzok and look at Bruce Orr right. and look at the whistleblower being a former Biden staffer who works for the CIA. Like he's not being named because he's the absolute worst possible whistleblower they could have hoped for, because he just plays right into central casting for Trump as an opponent, because he's just this weak little wimpy CIA leftist guy. Like, he's everything that Trump has fought against. I mean, so I think it becomes confusing for the average person because both of those have merit and they seem to make sense. Like, you've got this new anonymous book by the guy who wrote, guy or gal, woman.
It's called Anonymous, right?
Called Anonymous, who, you know, right. we're the steady state. We're taking care of keeping Trump in line. And as somebody who wants a disruptor, as somebody who wants to see significant changes in multiple policies across the federal government, it terrifies me that there are people out there who see it as their job to just ignore whatever the president says. I get that he's absolutely insane, but at the same time, it's your job, right, to follow through on what the president says. And you had some of that with Nixon, too, where it's like Alexander Haig looking at everybody going, if that guy orders the codes, you see this in The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein, right. Call me first before you launch the codes, okay?
Right. Although the big difference between Nixon and Trump is that Nixon really understood government.
Yeah.
And the bureaucracy.
Yes.
And he had guys like Henry Kissinger around him who also understood it and had a strategic vision. I think there are not many visionaries there today. I think this is very much like writing a script daily for, a daily serial. This is almost like, to me, some of this resembles a soap opera.
Would you say reality TV, Rob?
Oh, I would go beyond that. You know, reality TV is one thing. Reality TV happens once a week, right?
Right.
This is a soap opera. This is like Days of Our Lives. And you have new characters in every day, and somebody's good one day and bad the next day, and one day they're alive, and the next day they're dead, and then, oh, wait, they're not dead. They were a zombie or something else. But I do think that it's been observed before. He really wants to stay in the news. And, I've said it before. My bottom line on this is that this is not going to help the Democrats get him out of office. First of all, there's enough here to warrant an actual removal, probably. I think there will be I doubt there will be enough senators who believe there's enough to warrant removal. And partly because of the obvious politics involved in this and the history.
To your soap opera storyline idea, Richard Nixon is embedded and he understands power, but he's deeply corrupt. And for decades, we've all known this guy is corrupt. And then look, we've got evidence that he had people break in so he could seal his reelection. He's everything we've been saying he was for the last 25 years.
Right.
And now we've got tapes. You know,
yeah.
You look at Clinton. Clinton is a serial philanderer, and he is trying to cover up his affair with a young intern, and he's lying about it, and then we caught him with the blue dress and the DNA matches. Like, those are very easy elevator pitches for the opposition.
Right.
This is very complicated,
yeah.
And they don't want to really clean it up and make it easy to understand because they're all complicit in doing a lot of the same thing. So I just don't think that in terms of there's not much there because there isn't that damning evidence. There isn't that overarching storyline, and it fits into the narrative of you've all been trying to get me since the beginning, since day one, and now look, this is a fake witch hunt. And
right.
I just think voters are going to go, we have the opportunity to remedy this in 11 months. Why are you you're just going to remove anybody that is a conservative that you don't like? Like, the media can just run a five-year campaign to just get rid of the person that I voted for? Like, no, I'm going to vote for the guy just because you're trying to get him. So I don't think this is going to work.
And you realize, of course, they're running into the counter narrative, which is, oh my God, this guy has done so much in such a short period of time. And believe me, I hear that all the time.
Uh-huh.
I heard it from my brother and I said, yes, tell me. And he sends me a list, which he'd obviously copied from some website.
Breitbart, yeah.
And I don't think he reads Breitbart. He's actually my brother's a very well informed guy. He likes to put on country airs. he's not. But I hear it all the time. And I heard it again on TV this morning. I was watching one of the networks, and this is going to keep going on. And I think the problem here for the Democrats is they are running into the institutional issues, which is, I have a calendar, and the Senate's going to adjourn at some point, and it's going to probably, no matter how fast, they're already passed behind on the House side, and no matter how fast they do it, they're going to end up probably in January, right smack in the middle of the primaries for the Democrats. I will not be surprised if they force the whistleblower, so-called whistleblower, to testify, or he's outed somehow. And of course, they make a big deal around that. And then, so this is just going to go on. It's unfortunate. And by the way, you know, virtually anything can be impeachable. I just think a lot of people probably half the public feels that this may be bad. Some of them don't necessarily think it's bad, but is it worth all the rah-rah and hoorah that we have going on and all the waste of time and energy? And I think Nancy Pelosi is probably sitting there thinking, God, what have we done? And wishing she could have controlled them better. She knows the outcome. The outcome is going to be against the Senate. If this is all they've got, it's not going to be enough to change minds. Senate will not vote for it. Then half of these people, Elizabeth Warren and the others will, Cory Booker and Amy Klobuchar and these others will be trying to go back and vote and listen, and they have to be on the floor. They're the jury. They have to be there every day. And I don't believe that McConnell is going to give anyone any outs. I think he's going to hold them there. So the people out there will be Joe Biden and Mayor Pete and Tom, what's his name, the billionaire from California.
Stayer.
Yeah, right. And then some of these, and then Bloomberg and the crowd. And it's going to have a major impact on the Democratic primaries.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. So it's a brilliant TV show. I think Trump's going to win it, unfortunately.
I'm offended at what he did. Because I care about the Constitution, and I think he violated the Constitution, his constitutional authority. But I don't think most people could. I'm a nerd. I'm weird. I don't think most people could. They could care less. So what? It's business, man. You get something, they give something. Like, of course, quid pro quo. I'm all for it. So yeah.
Well, you notice. So there's been a lot of this in the media. So the Democrats have changed it from quid pro quo to bribery. Which is a very explicit term, you know, that has a long history in English common law, and it's very well defined. So I think they're going to have a hard time making the case that it's explicit bribery. Typically, in bribery, you have to have an offer and an acceptance, and then something for that. And it's not clear they're going to be able to prove that. And you're seeing some cracks and differences in testimony today and yesterday, and there'll be different versions, and they're going to have to try to sort it out and put it all together. But again, you know, I think people should not doubt the competence and serious intent and the national service profile of all these people coming forward, from whether they're political or whether they're professional life career, State Department or an NSC or something else. These people are, you should have to give them the professional benefit of the doubt. I suspect some people, as the one guy did today, said he didn't view it as sort of out of the ordinary when he first heard it or heard about it. And now, in light of all the rest, now he does. But yeah, so. Anyway,
do we have time for your dining guide to DC?
I haven't been. Well, you know, I actually did. I went to a really fun restaurant recently. I can't remember. I wish I'd thought about this beforehand, but I'll remember it next time. Next time, I'll tell you my dining guide to Nashville.
Excellent.
And when I see you, and I'll remember this other restaurant. I'm down here where I am in the Navy Yard. I've mentioned this before, you know, a couple of my absolute favorite restaurants are down here, and Chloe and Schilling and Salt Line and All Purpose and Pizza and Osteria Marini, fabulous Italian, and Anna at the District Winery. There's a winery down here on the waterfront, And, you know, every day there are new restaurants. There's a new Mediterranean one coming. And in general, I would say if you've got kids, and although winter is not quite so good, but if you have young kids or you just want to hang out on the waterfront, this is the place to be in Washington, much more so than the Wharf, which I love the Wharf, which is very modern. Lots of a couple big hotels there, so it's more touristy. This is where families hang out, and the builders in this area of town. And this is all new. You know, 10 years ago, there was nothing here but big parking lots and all that. And today, there are 35 or 40,000 new units of apartments and condos. Wow. And there's there's a hotel going in across the street from me here. This is the kind of thing you would like to see in an urban environment that's sitting on a riverfront where there's seating and walkways and cool bridges. And so
well,
I
just hope
my
next
general
time,
recommendation.
I just hope next time you can think of something. So just come up with some.
Okay.
Try to think about
it.
We'll
have more to talk about. We really need to do this within 2 weeks, Chris.
We really do.
There will be so much more in 2 weeks.
It'll be crazy. So, all right. Yes. Well, with that, we will say goodbye to Rob. I know he has dinner commitments.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to everyone who listens. We should be on next week, so stay tuned. Rob, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.